hurts. And I come a lot. And I average 1 month every year. And basically, I knew how nothing worked. Your string theory professor told me all these things I never know. He's been here like for a week and a half. Okay, so we found out that the beta function of QCD was negative, and that gave rise to this phenomena called asymptotic freedom. At short distances, large momentum transfers, the strong interactions are weak, and we can use perturbative methods. At long distances, the strong interactions get strong, or low momentum transfers, hence their name, and perturbative methods are not applicable. We also learned that this theory develops dynamically a scale that we called lambda QCD, and that's the scale, order of magnitude-wise, the energy scale at which the strong interactions became strong. And we were able to write the strong interaction coupling constant at any scale mu squared as 12 pi over 33 minus twice the number of quark flavors. So in, times the log of mu squared is what I put there. Mu squared over lambda QCD squared. And of course, if we're calculating some physical process, some short distance process, the appropriate mu squared to use is one of order the scale of that process. Yes?
So could there be more corrections to lambda QCD?
Oh, I forgot to say, yeah. Plus dot, dot, dot. This was lowest order in perturbation theory. It was the G cubed part of the beta function. And this formula changes when you go higher orders in QCD. Thank you. So in the non-perturbative regime, what happens is that at very long distances, if we have color sources, the color electric flux or whatever, you know, the analog of electrodynamics, collapses from a dipole configuration that you're more used to what's called a flux tube. And the flux tube has some fixed thickness. Here we're imagining a world with no light quark, so we can't screen it by popping out a quark-antiquark pair. And because it has a thickness, T of order 1 over lambda QCD, that's roughly fixed. As we pull more and more, pull it further and further apart, we have to put more and more energy into this flux tube proportional to the length. And so we get a potential V that goes like some constant times R. However, if we went to short distances, very short distances between these color charges, then we'd be in a regime where perturbative methods are appropriate, and you'd get a V that went something like alpha S at 1 over R, and if it's, and there's a particular factor here which we'll derive in certain circumstances later on in this lecture, so let me do it like this, but it's also attractive. So it looks like Coulombic at very short distances, apart from the running of the coupling constant, this logarithmic correction, and linear at log distances. This is something you can compute. This is something you can compute if you have non-perturbative methods available to you, like lattice QCD. I can't do it on the blackboard for you. This one I'll do on the blackboard for you later in this lecture in some circumstance. Okay, so this phenomena, this flux tube, means that it takes an infinite amount of energy to separate a quark and an antiquark, let's say, to infinite distances. And so we'll never see free quarks or antiquarks. They're always in bound states with zero total color charge. That's the phenomena of confinement. So if we have a quark and an antiquark, so usually if you have a bound state B, in quantum field theory, you can introduce a field operator. It's called an interpolating field that can destroy the state B. And if B is a bound state of certain constituents, then the composite operator is the interpolating field is a composite operator made up of the fields that compose the bound state. So, for example, if you have a quark-antiquark bound state, there's various different types of quarks called the flavor U, D, S, C, B, T. These ones are sometimes called heavy. These ones are sometimes called light. And in this classification of heavy and light, you mean heavy compared to lambda QCD and light compared to lambda QCD. Are they heavy compared to the scale at which the strong interactions get strong? And of course, these ones, the C and the B, they're moderately light and moderately heavy compared to these scales. But for these ones, it's a very good approximation. So the up and the down quarks, I'm telling you stuff I should have put in last time's lecture. So this is not just review here. The up and the down quarks, they have very small masses compared to lambda QCD. M up, M down are much, much less than lambda QCD. Well, that tells you that their masses don't matter much for the bound states. The bound state masses, at least most of the bound states, not the pions, most of the bound states, masses come from other sources, like this flux tube, for example, between the quarks or antiquarks in the mesons. And so if the masses don't matter very much, we can approximate them in some circumstances by zero. And if you do that, the up and the quarks, up and down quarks only differ. Then they have the same mass, it's zero. And they only differ by their electromagnetic charge, which is small, so we can neglect that difference. And so they both are color triplets, and so they behave exactly the same way under the strong interactions in that limit. And so you can take the strong interactions, you can combine the up and down quarks into a doublet, and the strong interactions will have a flavor symmetry where this doublet where U is an element of the SU2 group. Actually, we could make it U2 for this case if we wanted to, but let's just talk about the SU2 part of it. So if they're in the SU2 group, it's behaving like a doublet. This just rotates through unit. It's not really a rotation. It's a unitary transformation. But unitary transformations do represent it's a 2x2 unitary transformation. It just mixes up the up and down quarks, and all the dynamics of the strong interactions are invariant under those transformations. So it's a symmetry, a global symmetry of the theory. And that symmetry is called isospin symmetry. You know another situation where the same symmetry occurs. If you have an electron, let's say, electron can have two spins, spin up and spin down. And so you can form a doublet of those two spins, up and down. And if you perform rotations, well, I don't know what to call it. What should I label it? I'll just label it A and B. These are spins. If you make a rotation, and you freeze all the other degrees of freedom but the spin degrees of freedom, and this is also an SU2 transformation. That's what rotations are, acting on two-component Pauli spinners. And so that's why this is actually called isospin. It's completely analogous to spin. If you know how to make invariants under spin rotations, you know how to make invariant under isospin rotations. You just imagine electron spin up is the up quark, electron spin down is the down quark, and everything you know about spin goes over for isospin. Is that clear? Yes?
What would happen if you try to make the isospin symmetry local?
Well, that would be gauging the isospin, but the up and down quarks really are different, so it's not a good symmetry. This is an approximate symmetry. Gauge symmetries have to be exact symmetries, and also electromagnetism violates it. So it's not something we can gauge, but it can still help us understand the spectrum of hadrons, approximate symmetries like that, you classify the states into multiplets, which are almost degenerate in mass. Yes?
So this is the part, kind of the inspiration for Kellogg's eight-fold.
Right. So what happened is, in the 60s, people started to discover particles that were heavier than the ones made up of these. They also contained the strange quark. And people didn't know about quarks then. They knew about isospin, that it was useful, it was an approximate symmetry, the generators commuted with the Hamiltonian, almost. There were small terms that violated from electromagnetism and other sources, which they didn't attribute to quark masses. They didn't know what they were. And so they found all these other particles, and they looked at their masses, and they kind of were almost degenerate with some splitting, so they tried to put them into multiplets to organize things. And people didn't know what the symmetry group was. There were people that tried, you know, these really weird groups like G2. And basically, physicists didn't know anything but isospin. They didn't know Lie algebras, Lie groups. They wouldn't know how to do SU3. You know, they basically understood spin, they understood this. And then there were some of the more mathematical types of physicists who knew about groups like G2, but weren't so great at the physics part. You know, if you're going to try G2, you might as well try SU3 before that. But Murray Gell-Mann could learn the math. Well, he had to learn it, but he also was a very deep physicist. And so he figured out you could classify the spectrum using SU3, and the particles fell into these nice multiplets, and one was missing for one of the multiplets, but was later discovered, and he won the Nobel Prize for that. He didn't win the Nobel Prize for quarks. He ran it for SU3, which is the generalization of isospin when you add the strange quark to the list of light quarks. So if you have your particles, they usually fall into approximate isospin multiplets. So for example, this is Dublin, it's like spin a half. If you have three spin a halves, you can combine them to spin a half and spin three halves. And for ups and downs, that's the neutron proton is the spin a half combination, total spin a half. And the delta are the three halves. And so the neutron is composed of up, down, down. But in the combination of flavor, of up and down flavor, where it makes isospin a half. So if you wanted to, let me just leave it at that. And the proton is UU down, again, in the combination that's isospin a half. And then there's also the spin degrees of freedom of the quarks that you have to combine as well. And they're also color. They have color. They have a lot of indices. So the color, if you have three of them, you can make that a color singlet using the epsilon tensor. It doesn't matter upper or lower. So if I call this an interpolating field, a quantum field, a composite field, it would have an amplitude to destroy a neutron and an amplitude to destroy the delta, because I haven't decomposed it into the pure isospin a half and isospin three halves part. And similarly, the pions fall into a multiplet. There's the pi 0, the pi plus, and the pi minus, which are like spin 1. The only thing you have to be careful about is the pion, for example, is UU bar plus DD bar You might have thought from spin that this would be a plus sign. But the antiparticle transforms like the complex conjugate, and so there's an so if you have so the, if I have u bar d bar, it goes prime. That's the complex conjugate of this matrix. And so if you have something like exponential I alpha a t a, and you take its complex conjugate, you get minus I T A star, which is alpha A, which is I alpha A minus T A transpose. And so the complex conjugate representation transforms with generators that are minus T A transpose. And so the upper component of the doublet is actually the D bar, not the U bar, and the lower component is minus U bar. And so that flips the sign here. So this is actually part of an isospin 1 multiplet, even with the minus sign. And the pi plus is u d bar, and the pi minus is d u bar.
Mm-hmm.
That came just from this, and this involves a complex conjugation. Oh, sorry.
Okay.
Thank you. Okay, so that's a little bit more about the spectrum than I did last time. Okay, so I introduced for you before what was called the parton model, picking a particular example. It's an extremely important example, and I got most of the way through it, but I want to finish up a few more remarks about it. So the example we were doing was E plus E minus goes to hadrons. That's high. So we imagine we're having E plus E minus, and we're going to be working. So there's a center of mass energy S, which is PE plus PE minus squared. And we're going to be working in a region where S is much, much greater than lambda QCD squared. And hence, we're in a region where we expect to be able to use perturbative methods, and much, much less than mz squared. And so we can integrate the z out of the theory, pretend there's no z boson, work in an effective theory without it. And therefore, it's going to be a photon, gamma, that can create the quark and the antiquark pair, plus dot, dot, dot. And we'll add up all these Feynman diagrams, order by order in perturbation theory. There'll always be one e squared, and then it'll be powers of alpha s after that, because we'll work to lowest on trivial order in electromagnetism, because that coupling is weaker than the strong coupling. Oh, I think I forgot to tell you the value of the strong coupling. Yeah. So the strong coupling, we've measured it. Oh, I should put that on the board above. Dang. So alpha s and mz squared, they used to have these z factories, so there's a lot of data on z decays. It's a very good place to measure alpha s. What is 0.1184 plus or minus 0.000? Is that really that many zeros? We know it that well? It's in the particle data book anyways, you can check. So if when we get all the way up to mz, it's pretty small. But when we get down to like one GeV, it's a third or something. So it changes a lot over that scale. And that's alpha, remember, not g. G is about 1 to get this value of alpha because of the 4 pi in the definition of alpha s. OK, so we got a little confused, but we sorted it all out. And we decided that to calculate E plus E minus goes to hadrons, the cross-section, we could first calculate the cross-section for E plus E minus goes to quarks plus gluons, and multiply by the probability that they form hadrons, the quarks and gluons. And the reason was these two processes, the short distance process and the hadronization process, occur on very different timescales. So you would expect that there wouldn't be quantum interference between them, or the quantum interference would be small. And so you can multiply probabilities. If you had an extreme example, you know, you could imagine that lambda QCD was incredibly small, and they traveled a long, long way before hadronization was relevant. But we want the probability to form all possible hadrons. Well, we know, because of confinement, with probability 1, every quark and gluon will end up in a bound state hadron. And so this probability is 1. If we try to compute something less inclusive, this is called an inclusive final state, because you're allowing anything. If you try to compute a particular final state, I couldn't make an argument like this. The other thing to know is that this is not exact. There will be, I made an argument based on the impulse approximation, there will be corrections. Those corrections are not corrections in alpha s. This holds to all orders in alpha s. They're what's called non-perturbative corrections involving powers of lambda QCD divided by your energy scale S. So let's do this example. Let's write down a formula. I love formulas. They comfort me. I need to be comforted, especially when it's freezing outside. No. Well, there are some of that type, but usually what you do is you do something called an operator product expansion. You can characterize the non-perturbative corrections, in this case, in terms of vacuum expectation values of field operators suppressed by powers of S. And then, so it could be an expectation value of an operator like G mu nu over S squared. So in QCD, this would be something of order lambda QCD to the fourth over S squared. And you can figure out what those operators are and what their coefficients are using a systematic method. And
but that's not perturbative.
Pardon? It's non-perturbative. So you can figure out the operator. But to get the number, you need to take this vacuum expectation value. And that's non-perturbative. So you can learn something using methods called the operator product expansion. So I wasn't sure whether people had done that in field theory. I was guessing not. Yeah. So you know, it would require almost a week to really do it right so people understood it, given that you don't have the field theory background. But there is a systematic method to determine the operator, their coefficients, and also they come with powers of S. But the part that's non-perturbative is you then have to compute the matrix element. And instantons would contribute to those matrix elements, for example. Yes?
Did you say this correction comes from alpha?
There are corrections to this part of order alpha, but you can calculate this to all orders in alpha S perturbatively. But then there's corrections to the formula involving things like this. And you can figure out everything using methods called the operator product expansion, which are based on perturbation theory, plus some facts about field theory properties of operators. But then in the end, to get the cross-section, you have to calculate a vacuum expectation value. That you would have to do on the lattice or some other non-perturbative method. So I'm sorry I didn't. It's very interesting. I encourage you to if you come by, there's many textbooks you can learn about it. It's certainly an important part of the standard model and field theory worth learning about. And those methods, operator product expansion, they're used in string theory and condensed matter physics. Those are important general methods. And they're used in this case. Okay, so let's go ahead and let's compute the cross-section for E plus E minus goes to hadrons, at least at lowest order in alpha S. What's the lowest non-trivial, what's the lowest order we get an answer at? I know you're holding out for a quarter. This class. Okay, class. It's got a Mountie. I want to compute E plus E minus goes to hadrons. So that's E plus E minus goes to quarks and gluons. Look at, I drew a Feynman diagram. I drew the first one. How many strong interaction factors are there in here? Who said zero? There's none. There's just the E squared from electromagnetism. And we already calculated E plus E minus goes to mu plus mu minus. So all I got to figure out is how much color matters. And then I can write down the answer. Woo-hoo! So sigma E plus E minus goes to hadrons. Oh, shoot. Pen. My notes are wrong. I suck. They're on the web, too. So embarrassing. One day I'm just going to fall off this ledge, you know. Okay, so it's 4 pi over 3 e center of mass squared from what we did alpha. That was E plus E minus goes to mu plus mu minus. And then we sum over all the quarks that are light enough to be produced in this process, because they can occur in the final state. Different quarks, this is quantum mechanics. Different quarks are different final states. They don't interfere, right? You just calculate each one and add up those different final states. How many colors do the quarks come in? Three colors. They're a color triplet. If this is red, this is red. If this is blue, this is blue. If this is white, this is white. God bless America. Sorry. So we get a factor of three. And then this vertex here is proportional to the charge of the quark. So we get the charge of the quark of type I squared. And then there'll be plus order alpha s. So we usually write this as the sum over I, 3 qi squared. Oh, pen. I don't know why I'm correcting them. Maybe I'll put it back up on the web. Correct it. Oh. Oh, you haven't. Oh, you're anticipating more or errors. That's not a sign of confidence, actually. I'm a little nervous about that. R. And R is just this quantity you get from sigma E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus. And so you can try to measure R by calculating this cross-section and dividing out by the cross-section to E plus E minus to mu plus mu minus. And, you know, in different energy regions, R has different values depending on how many quarks kinematically can participate. And this formula, of course, is valid when the energy is much greater than the quark mass. So there's some transition region, and then this formula applies. So so let's say we're in a region where we could do up, down, strange, charm, but still below the threshold to make bottom quarks, which is about 10 GeV. Well, then what would we get? We would, this coefficient here, the coefficient multiplying R, would be minus a third for the 2 minus a third quarks squared plus 2 thirds squared times 2 times the 3 for colors. And so you get 4 times 2 is 8. Oh, shoot. Okay, so you get 4 times 2 is 8 plus, times 2. Plus 2 is 10. You get 9, so you get 10 thirds for R in this region. And there's data. You can check that against data, and the formula works pretty well. Sorry, that's not R. R is the coefficient of that. Oh, yeah. So it's 10 thirds units of R. Thank you. Okay. So that's one application of perturbative QCD. I'm going to step through some applications, and the last application that we're going to do is PP to Higgs, Higgs production and also Higgs decay. Yes? This 3 was colors. So every quark comes in 3 colors.
I would like to confirm the factor of 3 qi squared is so in the Feynman diagram, you have the...
So in the Feynman diagram, there's... But I'll tell you, in practice, what usually people do is they don't... You know, these things have color indices, the quark fields.
Is it similar to those like polarizations?
Yeah, it's like something over spins. And now you have to sub. Each quark comes not only with a spin label, but a color label. And in the final stage, you sum over spins and colors. So we're going to step through some applications. The most exciting application for you will be properties of the Higgs boson. Probably we'll get to that on Monday. But we're going to step through some of the applications of asymptotic freedom. So here we've done one. There's another application that involves the spectrum and properties of states in the spectrum. Now, I told you it's non-perturbative physics that gives rise to confinement. And we have a potential. At long distances, it goes linear with R. At short distances, it's Coulombic, and you can calculate that potential using perturbative methods. And so if we could have states that were only sensitive or mostly sensitive to the short distance part of the potential, then we could use perturbative methods to understand the properties of those states. So if you have a bound state of particles, the heavier the particles are, they're sensitive to the short distance part of the potential, because they settle down closer towards the bottom of the potential. And we do have heavy quarks. We have the bottom quark, and we have the top quark. And so bound states, for example, a bottom quark and an anti-bottom quark, to some extent, the charm as well, but I told you that was iffy, and the top quark and the anti-top quark, we should be able to use perturbative methods for that. Similarly, for a baryon that contains, say, three bottom quarks. That should be a problem that's mostly Coulombic plus small corrections. Those states involving the charm and the bottom, they're called onium, charmonium, bottomonium, they got names. The people who found them experimentally first got Nobel Prizes. And we can use our perturbative methods because of asymptotic freedom to study the properties of those states. Just like hydrogen, there's a ground state S wave, P wave excitations. They can see them all and study their masses, etc. So we'd like to understand at least a little bit about those states, a tiny bit. So that's the topic we're going to address right now. So first of all, you might think, well, we got the top at 175 GeV. The approximation is going to be awesome. So let's talk about the top. It ends up that this idea is totally useless for the top. Kind of ironic. Why is that? Well, remember, the top quark and the bottom quark, they decay via the weak interactions. They're not stable. So if they're interactions like the strong interaction, they have a typical time scale associated with them, given by 1 over lambda QCD. If you want to talk about the time it takes for a bound state to form, that would be order of magnitude wise, you'd use a number like that. So the time scale, 1 over lambda QCD, is some number like 10 to the minus 20 seconds. I just made that up. It might be minus 22. This is very crude. The life of a beat quark, but 1 over tau, let's convert it to 1 over tau is like something with dimensions of mass, is like lambda QCD. The lifetime of a B quark is 10 to the minus 12 seconds. So it does decay via the weak interactions. A bottom quark goes to the charm quark, and then you have this virtual W boson that could materialize to an electron and its antineutrino. It disappears into lighter objects. But this lifetime is enormous. 10 to the minus 12 seconds on the scale of the time scales of strong interactions is enormous. So as particle physicists, we live in a world where 10 to the minus 12 seconds is forever. Don't you think that's just so cool? Yeah, probably explains why I had trouble getting a date in high school, the fact that I think this is so cool. But nonetheless, I do think it's cool. But the bottom quark, the top quark, because of its very heavy mass, how does the top quark decay? It decays to a bottom quark, and it's so heavy, it makes a real W boson, two-body decay. And if you calculate the decay width, gamma for a top quark, which is 1 over the lifetime of the top quark, that's like, I don't remember, it's something like, around 1 GeV. So it's not long-lived compared to the scale of the interactions. These bound states really don't form. And so unfortunately, the quark for which the approximations would be the best doesn't form these bound states. So we got to talk about the BB bar bound states and the CC bar bound states. Everybody understand that physical argument? Okay. So let's go on. I'm going a little slow now because there's actually a lot of physics in these discussions. If you have the physics right, you can do all the other applications. For Higgs production and production, there's another one piece of physics we have to get, and then the rest is just arithmetic. So let's say I want to make up a state, just the way you did in non-relativistic quantum mechanics. Talk about a state of a quark and an anti-quark. It could be the charm or the bottom, heavy ones, let's say. Well, I could label the state as a quark, and we're just going to focus on the color indices now. Quark of a given color, anti-quark of a given color beta, and then there's what you might call your color wave function, just like you have a spin wave function, and it would be delta alpha beta here over root 3, summed over alpha beta. In other words, well, if I want to call the colors 1, 2, 3 instead of red, white, and blue, then this would be Q1, color 1, anti-quark of color 1, plus quark of color 2, anti-quark of color 2, plus quark of color 3, anti-quark of color 3. And then to get a properly normalized state, I have to divide by the root 3. So that's how we form the color part of the state. And similarly, if I want to make, so this is for the mesons. And if I want to make the baryons, there's another state psi. And that state would look like Q alpha, Q beta, Q gamma. And then I'd contract it with epsilon alpha beta gamma. And so now there'd be 6 terms in this sum, 3 factorial, because alpha beta gamma go over 1, 2, 3. This is the anti-symmetric Levy-Civita tensor. And so to get it properly normalized, I put a root 6. So that's what I mean by the states. And so what I'd like to, these are heavy quarks. And so the part of this, we have a potential that at very long distances goes like kappa times r. At very short distances goes like something over r with some coefficient we want to compute. And for these very heavy quarks, they feel mostly the wave function's dominated by the Coulombic part of the potential. And so we should be able to calculate that from one gluon exchange, just like you calculate the Coulomb force from one photon exchange. Your Fourier transform, the propagator, at zero time transfer, and that gives you the Coulomb potential. OK, so let's draw some pictures and do some computation. This whole section is applications of asymptotic freedom. We could call it onium. These states are called bottom onium states or charm onium states. So it's the part of the spectrum of QCD that you can tackle using perturbative methods because of asymptotic freedom. So basically, because of time factors, I want to step through what I think the major applications of asymptotic freedom are using perturbative methods. And so far, we've understood if you have initial states that are electrons, don't involve hadrons, but the final states do, how to use asymptotic freedom. Now we're going to do the spectrum. And then the last thing I do will be the case where your initial states contain quarks and gluons, plus final states might also. And then we have to introduce further concepts to apply asymptotic freedom. Okay, so should I go on? Oh, you had a question, sorry.
Born in the middle? So
here or here?
On the middle. You said that, so if the electron positron decay, for example, U and U bar.
Produce, not decay.
Yes, sorry. This is U and U bar, or G and D bar, that they don't interfere.
Right.
Is that exactly?
Well, in quantum, there are orthogonal states in quantum mechanics. You calculate the amplitude, you square, and then you sum over the different states, and that's how you calculate rates. And that's true with Fermi's golden rule, or non-relativistic, relativistic. That's part of understanding how you make measurements in quantum mechanics. You choose a basis, an orthonormal basis, and then you sum for the calculate the amplitude to each of the final states. You square that amplitude and then sum over those states. So that would be atomic transitions or these things in particle physics. Okay. So let's start with the mesons. So we have a meson. We're going to draw a picture. It's just it's kind of not a Feynman diagram. I don't know what it is. It's part Feynman diagram, part something else. So we have our quark in the bound state. So these things end up in a bound state. And these things end up in a bound state. And this one's the quark, and this one's the anti-quark. And at this vertex is GTA. And at this vertex is minus GTA transpose. And these have indices alpha, beta between them. And so you get 1 over root. So I could put the minus here, because that was how we defined the generator. So I get the 1 over root 3 from the, we're just taking into account color factors. We get the 1 over root 3, the 1 over root 3. We get delta alpha beta for here and here, let's say, that state. And then we're going to get GTA alpha, let's say gamma, and G minus TA transpose beta delta. And then we'll get delta to sew together the indices in this with this wave function, delta, delta, beta, delta, delta, gamma. Does it bother you to have delta sub delta? Yes?
Why do you have in the diagram at the bottom negative TA transpose?
So you have two ways of thinking about this. One way is to not do this and draw the arrow the other way and recognize its V-spinners, which, when you do the non-relativistic reduction, have an extra minus sign. Or just to think of them at how they transform under color, and then the Feynman rule would be this. So there's just two different ways to get the non-relativistic reduction. Either way is fine. Because this is an anti-quark. So in non-relativistic quantum mechanics, the anti-quark and the quark, they're not connected. They're separate particles. And so you don't introduce U and V spinners. You give them different charges in the Feynman rule. So this is color. And I showed you the generators acting on anti-quarks were minus TA transpose because they transform with the complex conjugate unitary matrix. And so that's what you put in for the vertex. In this non-relativistic theory, where the quark and antiquark are just separate particles and not connected. So there's no V-spinners, there's just quarks and antiquarks with two component. We're doing non-relativistic quantum mechanics.
How come if what happens with the quark is separate from what happens with the antiquark, then how come there are indices on both as though
they both have color? Right? They both have color. They have color indices.
But
so in the non-relativistic theory, you now have two objects, a color triplet and a color anti-triplet, the particle and antiparticle. And the generators for those representations are TA and TA transpose. And so when gluons couple, they couple proportional to the generators for the appropriate representation. That's how non-relativistic or relativistic, you want to have the gauge invariant.
But is there summing over the gauge?
Absolutely. There's Feynman rules, and the gluon goes across, and there's a delta AB for color. And so if I called this B, there'd be the delta AB for this line, and so you'd end up with AA.
And how come, so the delta AB, look rather like the delta AB in our expression for a state. How come?
It's a different one.
Okay.
There's Feynman rules. So your propagator for the gluon is I in momentum space. The gluon carries color, it carries indices. So if you had a gluon here with color A and color B and momentum Q, and you worked in Feynman gauge, you'd have a propagator like this. So it sews together the gamma matrices, and it sews together the color indices. And in the non-relativistic reduction, it's really the not-not component that dominates to get the potential. So I'm assuming that you know a little bit about how you get non-relativistic electrodynamics from quantum electrodynamics, but I'm not using any more than that. Anyways, if you don't understand that, this is where if you hadn't seen the how you get non-relativistic electrodynamics from quantum electrodynamics, I've told you how all the pieces go. Okay, so what do we get? So I haven't kept track of the Q, that gives you the 1 over R, or any of that stuff. I'm just trying to show you how it differs from electrodynamics. So electrodynamics, there'd be no matrices here, there'd be E and minus E. So if you work it all out, doing the contractions, you get minus G squared over 3, and then you get trace TATA. So you just follow these indices, take the transpose, and do the contractions. That's what you get. And that's 4/3 G squared. Using the things I told you before about the TATA is 4/3 the identity, and the identity gives you, traced over gives you a 3. And so what have we learned? What have we learned? If we're doing a meson, we want to understand the spectrum of B, B bar bound states. What would you do? You take your non-relativistic notes from when you were a child, and you studied in great detail E plus, E minus bound states. You probably didn't study them in great detail. So then you take your notes from when you studied hydrogen, you make the appropriate changes to make it appropriate for E plus, E minus, and maybe you have to work out a few more things. These non-relativistic bound states, they have a spectrum, formulas for the energies, S wave, P wave, yada, yada, yada. How do we find what's going on here? Well, we had here a potential. It was a two-body problem. V of R was equal to minus E squared over R. And to do BB bar, all you do is you take the mass of the electron in this problem and switch it to the mass of the bottom quark, which is measured to be, you know, about 4.5 GeV. And you take E squared, and you don't just replace it by G squared. Because of the color, you replace it by 4/3 times G squared. Is that clear? And then you can take every formula you have here, make these replacements, and know all the properties of those states. To leading order in alpha S, there's corrections. Because, you know, there's things like the 3 gluon vertex, et cetera. Plus, there's a long distance part of the potential that goes like R that you're a little bit sensitive to. But that one wasn't, yes?
Is it a minus sign? Or?
No, the minus sign came from here.
Oh, I see.
So I pulled that out.
Right. And then I traced over it?
And then I wrote the transpose, so I flipped the indices, right. Then I used the deltas and noticed it assembled to a trace.
Yeah. But then going from there to the next one, it's the sign flipped.
Oh, it's supposed to be minus.
Yep.
It's supposed to be G's. Yes. Thank you. Yeah. Sorry.
In previous times when we used Feynman diagrams, diagrams, and then you said this is just like a line diagram. You said that we want to get something in particular, like a scattering amplitude. Can you tell me what exactly that object that we think it is?
Well, I mean, you could call it a Feynman amplitude. Well, what I've computed is a matrix element, quark, anti-quark, quark, anti-quark, and I've left out the propagator, just the factors involving color. And then, if you wanted to, that's how you calculate a potential. It ends up to calculate a potential. You look at diagrams of this type. If these were electrons, that's how you'd get the 1/r Coulomb potential. For amplitudes, transition amplitudes and things, what happens is you put in wave functions here and integrate over the wave functions, and you can get amplitudes. But you can just consider a Feynman diagram for quark, anti-quark scattering through this term. And that term will give us potential scattering. And we're just trying to extract the potential from the Feynman diagram. But it's a little bit unusual. It's the non-relativistic Feynman diagram. So I haven't got this anti-quark arrow going the other way. So, and no V-spinners, there's just poly-spinners. Okay? Yeah?
When you wrote TA and minus TA at a...
Minus TA transpose.
Transpose at a different vertices, you already summed over the propagator between them. I mean, the boson, the...
Right, I've used this Kronecker delta of A and B.
So, it technically should be minus TA B transpose and then with the propagator.
Right, and the propagator contains a delta A B.
Okay, and what happened to the Q squared, the momentum?
So that Q squared dependence is what gives you the 1/r. But that's exactly the same as electrodynamics. You already know that answer. I don't have to redo the part you've already done, right? You know the electrodynamics potential is 1/r. So I just want to figure out the difference that color makes. So I got to put in the color wave function. So the reason it's not just a Feynman diagram is I put in the 1/√3s for the color wave functions and summed over them, because I know that's the wave function of the state. So this way, what we're getting here is the factor. Once I make this replacement, I can pretend color doesn't even exist and just go ahead and use this. Oh, I'm sorry, it's G and MB. You have to evaluate it at the right place. So once I make this replacement, I've already done all the color stuff. You just treat it as if there was no color. And that gave us this 4/3. Everybody with me? Okay, so now we've got to do the baryons. And they're a little trickier. Okay, so baryons. So baryons come with three of them, all particles, and then each of them interacts through some two-body force given by one gluon exchange in the perturbative regime. So let's just do one of them. Let's say it's acting between these two quarks. And here there'll be a GTA and a GTA, and what am I going to get? As far as color flow is concerned, these colors are put together with an epsilon over √6. And then I have final colors, which go, I'll just call them prime. And then I'll have GTA alpha alpha prime across this one, the alpha index, GTA beta, beta prime. And there's no interaction here, so the color here just has to match the color here. Otherwise, you'd get zero. They'd be different color states. And so I'll just get a Kronecker delta, as far as color is concerned, of gamma and gamma prime. Does everybody understand that? So try and do the same thing before. Figure out how to convert this to a problem in electrodynamics with some replacements. You with me? Okay, so first of all, I get the 1/6, I get epsilon alpha beta gamma, epsilon alpha beta gamma. doing the Kronecker delta, I get the g squared. And then I get TA alpha alpha prime, TA beta beta prime. Remember, repeated indices are summed over 1, 2, 3. And then I use this handy dandy identity, which says that alpha beta gamma epsilon alpha beta, alpha prime beta prime gamma is equal to delta alpha alpha prime, delta beta beta prime minus delta alpha beta prime delta beta alpha prime. So this formula is obvious apart from the overall factor, but let's just check the overall factor works. If I contract on gamma, these are color epsilons, we would get 6. If I contract on alpha and alpha prime, beta and beta prime, I would get 6. And this is 3 times 3 is 9, minus 3 is 6. And so I've got the right coefficient. OK? So let's use this identity. What does this term contribute? So each of these has to multiply this, and then we take the difference of them. So what does the first one contribute? The TAs are 3x3 traceless Hermitian matrices. Who said 0? Yeah. Let me give you a hint, class, because there's money on the line. If I ask you a question like that, I wouldn't really ask you something you had to do a serious computation in real time, the answer will almost always be 0 or infinity. So you got like a 50% chance of getting the right answer. Now, I actually want you to think about the physics, right? This is the trace of TA times the trace of TA, and they're traceless. So that's 0, and look at that! Can I say that again? We got a minus sign. A minus sign will make it attractive. And then again, you get trace. You sort of get, if you write the indices, and so you get minus 2/3 g squared. So if you have the potential between two electrons, let's say this is a bound state made up of 3 quarks, all quarks, no anti-quarks. So if you have electrons and you have a pair of them, the potential between them is repulsive. In this case, the potential after you take care of all the color, you would replace the electrodynamics one by taking E squared and potential and replacing it by minus 2/3 E squared, minus 2/3 G squared, and if it's a bottom quark at MB. And so we'll get, even in the Coulombic region, the short distance region, we're going to get an attractive force between the quarks inside these baryons made up of heavy quarks because of how the color factors work. Yes?
So there would be
absolutely. There'll be things like this that also contribute to the potential, higher order perturbative corrections, and non-perturbative ones as well.
Mm-hmm. Does this process describe in the proton and neutron,
the quarks aren't heavy, and so it's really long distance physics, so it's not a useful approximation.
So what kind of process is this?
So you could have something made up of a bottom quark and two charms. These mesons exist, and they're all heavy, and so you would use it for that. But mostly it's used for the mesons. Not nearly as much is known about the spectrum of these objects.
Could you say that the attractive nature of the force is surprising. I would just think that the attractive nature of the force would be surprising if we that the force of between species that have the same charge.
Well, they do. They're both color triplets. In this case, it's not a meson. It's quark, quark, quark. They're all color triplets, the same color charge. But because they're in a state that's a color singlet, the effective charge between them, when you do all the color indices carefully, taking into account how they go in the states and in the interaction, ends up giving you an attractive interaction. So it's kind of an interesting piece of physics. Okay. Oh, shoot. I took up the whole lecture on this. Doesn't matter. It's important. Okay. Well, next class, we're going to start the final application of perturbative methods. And it's the one that's most topical. This is Thursday, right? I got another day this week. Okay. Yeah. I remember when my father-in-law, at some stage, he was getting older, so he went for this Alzheimer's test, and my wife and I went with him. So they asked him all these questions, like, you know, this and that, and you know, I didn't know the answer to half the questions. You know, I'm looking at my physics all the time, working 6.5 days a week, 12 hours a day, thinking about physics. I didn't know, so I felt bad for him. But anyways, Anyways, what are we going to do next? The thing you've heard about, that, you know, we got this LHC, it turned on, it collides protons. And they're very high energy collisions. So you'd think that somehow what would be going on is the quark and the anti-quark in the protons would be colliding and producing the stuff. But they're in the state where non-perturbative physics matters. And so we have to figure out how to handle that. And that's what we'll do next time. I'll basically motivate heuristically for how we handle it, and we'll start the phenomenology of that. I think it'll take 2 to 3 lectures to do the examples, and we'll do Z production and Higgs production, and then we'll also do Higgs decays, because the Higgs is heavy. The part of its decays that involve hadrons you can also handle with the asymptotic freedom. And then the last week or fraction of a week, we'll start to talk about some of the other phenomenology of the standard model. And there's a second standard model class, so before I leave, I'll tell Natalia and Philip the main parts that I left out, so they'll fill them in, so you won't end up with gaping holes in your knowledge of the standard model. Okay, I'll see you tomorrow.